WLIB, good afternoon. You're inside of the GBE. Thank you for joining us.
Peace and love, my brother.
Thank you. I want you to make sure you turn your radio all the way down. And for the other callers, please do that. It'll save us time. Go right ahead.
Yes. I'm listening. This is very, very interesting. And what I'm interested to know is if there was a possibility. See, I listen to you, Gary, and I admire you to the utmost, and so do your audience. And we talk about leadership in the black community, and you, I see you as a model, all right? And brothers like your guests and other brothers like Automatics and just the series of brothers who have been fighting in the revolution, if all of us as a nation of black people right now would pool in our monies, and like people like you, Gary, and people that I have mentioned who can oversee, we'll pool in all of our hundreds of millions of dollars, and you all being the monitors, the leaders of that, and us monitoring because we trust you. We have to look at it now realistically. We understand our predicament and our position, what we got to do about it now. So, I mean, Gary, let's make a call out. I'm calling out to the community now as I'm sitting here and I'm listening. We should put together a board of electors of the brothers that are mentioned and so forth and so on. Because these are the brothers that we trust and we believe in.
Let me just step in for a moment because we're moving a little bit towards news headlines. But I hear the caller coming with, I think, the economic energy and the thrust of that whole reality, which has come up on this program so much. And I know that you have some perspectives about that, Professor Wilson. So what we'll do is this. To the caller, I want you to update yourself with the local, national, international news headlines for just a moment. And Professor Wilson, when we come back, we'll pick up on the economic dimensions of your question and certainly what I think is a very honest and sincere call for the idea of us coming together and doing something. And maybe we'll talk about some of the reasons why that hasn't happened and some of the things that have to happen for it to happen when we come back right after this. At 1190 WLIB, World Leadership in Broadcasting. Amos Wilson, our topic is the psychology of self-hatred among global African people. And we had a caller just a moment ago who raised the economic dimension and certainly, I guess, the economic possibility. I constantly have had conversations about the potential that we have in terms of being an economic force. And it there's no point in repeating the numbers of us who are in churches, right, community organizations, and how in just one weekend, you know, we could raise, you know, obviously enough money to create our own banking system.
Certainly.
In one weekend. Professor Wilson, that caller was reaching out.
That's in part the effect of the self-hatred, which leads to a squandering of economic resources. The inability of the black community to use this tremendous economic wealth for its own interests is indicative of the issue that we're talking about here today.
Mm-hmm.
We will, I hope, get around to talking about, when I talk about the effects of dealing with self-hatred, one of the effects, of course, is the misspending of money. And
how so though? How does that work?
Because the money is misspent again to relieve pain, you see, to compensate for inferiorities, and because the individual has been reversed, which we'll have to explain at some later point, you will see a situation where almost inevitably the spending for getting over an inferiority complex involves spending the money with the person who gave it to you in the first place.
Okay. Wait a minute. There's something you have, yeah, a thing about anger and resentment binding the oppressor to the oppressor.
Yes, and this is a part of the aspect of it, you see.
Mm.
You want to buy the approval. You want to buy, you mentioned even in the Garvey statement, you want to buy the products that restructure the image. And because you see, the essence of controlling people is to provoke a desire in them. And then, of course, have control of the satisfaction of that desire. You see?
Mm.
And that's at the foundation of the capitalist system and of the economic system, you see. And you can provoke that desire in them either through anger, through hatred, through direct tantalizing of the individual. See, the key to being in the ruling class is to create desire first.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And to have control over the resources for the satisfaction of the desire.
So provoke a desire, then service the need.
Then service the need.
Yeah.
But you also lay the conditions down for getting the need serviced. And that way you create the behavior in the process. And you create the personality in the process.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and those who can't get into that don't fit.
No. No, not at all. So, so the idea is, if you feel, so if you're cursed, often we say your behavior then will involve trying to get the person to remove the curse, which sends you back to the individual asking their acceptance. And of course, often they will make a few demands on you, which you have to fulfill before you can gain that acceptance, back again. If you feel as if, and see what happens when we were robbed, and we are robbed as people. We see who have it, but who has what has been robbed from us. But we also forced to buy it back because we can't buy it from ourselves. We don't have it. You see, and so when we try to compensate for a loss of status by dressing well, we got to go to Bloomies or somewhere, you know. When we try to compensate for a loss of a status by buying a house, we go to the white community, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Or by eating at, and we want to show those people that we're as good as they are, so forth. You see, all of this effort to compensate and prove something and to be accepted and all of this kind of be, or to escape, is going to send you directly back to the people who created the situation in the first place.
Amazing.
You see, so it works very beautifully. That caller had an implication there that was, that again, people don't deal with, except I've seen Chancellor William deal with it in his book, and I try to get people to understand, read the whole of the Chancellor William book, because often they read it as history, you see.
Let's give book titles here, too.
Yeah, The Destruction of Black Civilization.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, at the back part of that book, he's dealing with, of course, Reconstruction, and he's dealing with political, social, and economic plans. Of course, when you study the movement of Marcus Garvey, as well as the movement of Elijah Muhammad and others, you see it implied there. And that implication is nation building.
Mm-hmm.
The creation of a national network, economic, social, political network by black people, and a national economic program of development, political, social program by black people. Now, I don't want this to be interpreted as advocating the overthrow of the United States government, okay?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm talking about the kind of informal organization that you often find in other ethnic groups that have, you know, so-and-so congresses and congress of leaders from various regions and situations of this kind that come together and have a policy, political, social, economic policy, which is coordinated nationwide and then into worldwide as well. We have not done that. We have the foundation for it. We have
right.
a whole network of black churches. You also saw the network being laid in Elijah Muhammad's system as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to look at that, see how we can informally set up this kind of network, because once we do this, we can lay the basis for real productive economics. And I will talk later on about how productive economics in the United States is tied to the productive economics of African people the world over. And the economic activity of black people in this country is crucial to economic development of African people the world over.
Professor Amos Wilson at WLIB, good afternoon. You're in The Experience. Go right ahead, please, with your question or comment.
Good afternoon.
Okay, make sure you turn your radio all the way down. It's going to save us a lot of time. Everybody, if you're listening, I'm going to say this one time. Please make sure that you are near your radio and make sure that it's right there at your fingertips to turn it right away at a lower volume so that we can save as much time as possible. We thank you. Go right ahead, please.
Yes. Mr. Bird, thank you so much for having Professor Amos Wilson on. And your WLIB is doing a fantastic job in
thank
opening
you.
Up the consciousness of African Americans.
Thank you.
I simply wanted to state that my father gave us a Bible, and that was the philosophy and opinion of Marcus Garvey. We did not have a white Christ in our home.
Mm-hmm.
He painted it black. And it had a profound effect on our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the younger people in the family have also had this kind of awakening. And as Professor Amos pointed out, there is a punishment. I have been dealt a punishment. Mm-hmm. Through another step of the Skinner experiment. How does one deal with coping in the system when you are punished, even though you might excel? How is one able to escape the punishment that is dealt at you?
How do you escape the black ache? Here we go.
Often, frankly, there is not an escape, per se. One thing we have to recognize, and I've recognized personally, is that when you accept certain positions, given the nature of the way things are, you're going to have to accept certain consequences. Not accept them in that you think you should have them, but you know that they are going to occur. And I've often told many people, if you really are going to go deeply into the philosophies that we're talking about here of nationalism and so forth, you have to realize that you are going to suffer some consequences. You're not going to be socially mobile all of the time, and you're going to lose some things. But with a deep understanding, it means often then giving up some of those desires that have been artificially created in the first place, so that the loss of them or the non-attainment of them does not represent a painful loss for you as an individual and a person. A deep understanding, too, of the consequences and of oneself and the nature of one's enemies, and a deep spiritual, and I'm not talking about the spookism religion, okay, of will allow one then to suffer these privations with a certain peace of mind. You see, a certain centeredness that permits one to bear these kinds of pains.
Is that being done, though, with a particular goal or objective in mind?
Well, yes, because you realize you're going to pay a price for it. And it's hardly a way you're going to escape it.
You can't.
Very unlikely. And therefore, what you want to do is create a spirituality, a personality system that has, like I said, it's not overly caught up with the values and other kinds of things that the system creates, so that one can find a harmony and a sense of self-love even in the midst of these kinds of consequences, to create certain kinds of relationship with people and groups and families that can maintain one, because you don't have to be unhappy.
Right.
Okay? And you don't have to be in agony, even though you're not getting what you deserve, in a sense, in terms of your
truth. You mentioned relievers of pain a bit earlier, and I think it relates to what this caller is speaking, but you talked about sex addiction, drugs. There's a whole series of quote-unquote pain relievers that have emerged within the context that this caller is speaking of.
And being also, you know, and of course, being very much into the advancement of black people and of African people, making that at the center of one's life, which gives you a very deep sense of purpose and devotion, which makes then often the other kinds of things that are laid on you, the consequences, have far less... I make them far less painful in that sense, because of this focus and because of this purpose, you see. And so I found in my own personal life, it's this kind of thing, this focus and this purposefulness of life, in the sense that what one is doing is supremely worthwhile and worth much more than what one is losing. That's very important.
WLIB, you're on there with Professor Amos Wilson. Go right ahead, please.
Hello, Gary, Professor Wilson.
Good afternoon.
Thank you. In the 60s, we saw and felt the presence of the Muslim community. They stood out in our community as positive. They stood out from the rest of the community.
Yes.
We need the large African community to come forward and take its, not temporary, but permanent position at the front. I think in the weekend, we should maybe put on a dashiki or some symbol of our African ancestry. I'm not saying to start going into the office immediately to create a scene with the dress codes. But we must move forward and let that African presence be felt. We have to set up our national congress. We will have to include our historians, lawyers, and other professionals who have left the plantations, because not all of them are right. So I say to all Africans, we have a message to send. We must beat our own drum to send this message, because for a long time, others have been beating our drum but sending their message.
Definitely. And I agree with you fully. The Muslims under Elijah Muhammad in particular, I think, made a great example. Of course, Marcus Garvey as well, as to what we could do if we continued to expand that example and develop that example. And I think we should study it, the nation under Elijah Muhammad, particularly in the earlier phases, and look at it very closely and use it as a basis and foundation, and not permit the later events that a lot of people get carried away with, you know, and permit those things to blind us to the really good aspects of what was being developed there. I think it's a good model. There are other people, too, that we can look at as well in terms of developing a model for moving forward. I think also the change in the influence sometimes of Islam can also be instructive as well, because it speaks to the issue of the balance between quote-unquote religion and politics, and what happens when quote-unquote sometimes the religious aspect and the orthodox religious aspect becomes so predominant until often it knocks out other things.
We'll take a break for just a couple of minutes, and we're going to come back with our guest, Professor Amos Wilson. We are going to be with him until 4:30 this afternoon, so for those of you listening, we're going to do our best to get to every single one of your calls. So please stand by for as long as you can, and we'll come back and get back to you as soon as possible. 1190 WLIB, you're inside of the Great Black Expedition. We'll come back with more inside of the GBE, our topic, the psychology of self-hatred among global African people. More after this. You're on the air with Professor Amos Wilson.
Hello.
Go right ahead, please.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I just would like to make a statement. I noticed that white people tend to resent black people referring to themselves as brothers and sisters. Could you make a comment on that?
Definitely. It implies, of course, the brothers and sisters implies a certain unity of purpose and a certain group cohesiveness. And of course, the European system thrives on and is based on a lack of cohesion and a lack of unity of black people. So consequently, when that term is used often, fear and anxiety and resentment is provoked in many Europeans, who interpret it to mean that here are a group of people now who are united and who may then unite against our domination.
WIB, go right ahead, please. Your question, please.
Hello, Brother Gary, and good afternoon, Brother Wilson.
Good afternoon.
First of all, I'd like to accuse both of you of being sane. And secondly, I was realizing that there's a lot of political polygamy that the brother didn't explain. I know he'll get to it because he's very thorough. I had tried about 3 weeks of being a Negro. I found out I couldn't cut it. I had also tried other people's religions. So I had the good fortune of meeting the brother, and we talked a little bit. And I think that we had agreed that we should have an African religion coming to us out of voodoo. We could avoid all of the other stuff that the people has been laying on us, because as in voodoo, you do not have any white images. Mm-hmm. Would you comment on that, please?
Very, very important. And, of course, it's great to hear from you. At the risk of making a personal communication, I was listening last night, early this morning, to a beautiful poem being read. It was fantastic. I have to congratulate you on that. Of course, it's very important that we have religious images that represent us as people. You know, people often startle when I say the church will lead you to hell. And one of the illustrations I make about that is that often in the church is a direct breaking of a major rule. And that rule is, thou shalt not have make unto me any graven images. And yet you walk into church where you have a graven image, as we talked about earlier, of the white Jesus there, and a graven image representing a God, a God-like figure, which violates the very basic command of God itself. And in a sense, you can, that in itself symbolizes a breaking of a fundamental rule by the church itself. And of course, one of the reasons why you do not make graven images unto God is the fact that people identify with that image. I often say that people, in praising their gods, in ultimately in some way praise themselves and respect themselves. And in giving respect to their gods, they give respect to themselves. And I think an aspect of black self-respect will be, of course, a God that represents the black image.
1190 is WLIB. It's World Leadership in Broadcasting. The news is next at the top of the hour with Wayne Gilman. I'm Gary Bird. You're inside of the GBE. We'll move from the Great Black Expedition to Live Before 5, and we'll be taking you with us, along with Professor Amos Wilson.
Okay. Short, so what we need is an organization that even if the individual goes, the organization remains. And I wonder if your guest has an idea of how such an organization could be set up.
Okay. I talk a great deal now about economics. I really try to get across this idea of the tremendous importance of economics to self-respect. We get a lot of conversation here at LIB and other places about the greatness of African people. And we hear about Egypt and Ghana and this one and that one. But too often, the conversation does not get into how and why these great civilizations came to being. In any great civilization, if you're going to talk about Egypt, you're going to find at the base of it a great economy. Mm-hmm. And if you're talking, and you often the impression is given that these people are great because they praise Ra or Ramses or someone else, mm-hmm, was ahead of them. Or we talk about the greatness of the pyramids without recognizing that the pyramids have to be paid for. You have to have an economy to build pyramids. You have to have an economy to build giant temples. And even though you pray to God, Ra's and so forth, this men who build them in the long run, even if you built them by slavery, you had to provision those slaves and the whole bit. So what you recognize in Egypt is a tremendous economy. What you will recognize in Ghana, again, is an economy, a control of gold and salt mine, a control of trade routes. Mali, the same thing. Have to gain an economic niche in this world and have control and engage in trade. And that means we're going to have to engage in basically all areas of trade. We have to recognize that to survive, we're going to have to compete with numbers of ethnic groups. That even means ethnic groups within the so-called third world. As well, we have to face this possibility. We have to compete with the Japanese. We have to compete with people in Latin America and Central America. And I'm not talking about hostility, but this is a fact of life. This knowledge and how this is to be done has to be transmitted to black people and black children the ways that everyone else does it, through education, through teaching, through apprenticeships, and through organizing people so that their economic behavior can help to create an economic base. I think one of the ways we can do it, and there are other ways, is to recognize that the standard economic education that blacks receive in the universities is not sufficient to advance black economic interests. I say, isn't it ironic that you could have almost a direct relationship between the number of Asian businesses owned in Harlem and the number of blacks who receive degrees in business administration? So I'm sure in the last 10 years, you can point to it a larger number of black degrees in business administration person in degrees in economics, and at the same time, you can point to the larger influx of Asians and other groups owning the black community, which says one thing, that these degrees are not designed for you to have control of your economy, which implies another thing, that you have to educate your own people to do it, and you have to forget about being legitimized by white standard institutions, build and construct your own legitimate institutions by actual education, by engaging in businesses and apprenticing young people into those businesses to actually build into them a business attitude. Get rid of this old idea of individual capitalism, which went out a long time ago, but many blacks are still hung up with this concept of individual capitalism, that they are going to build a business for themselves. You train a small number of individuals to begin with thoroughly. Then you get that small number of individuals to train others by what we call geometric growth. Within a short fraction of years, you could have trained economically a whole corps, a couple of thousand or more people, who would have been spread completely over the country, who would now have a connected network, one with the other, whose goal would be to move in their specific communities in positions of influence and so forth to lay an economic network and foundation for the creation of a black economy. And then from there, we'll do what everybody else does, build schools, institutions, and everything else for the continuing development of our system and advancement of our system.
WLIB, you're on the air with Professor Amos Wilson.
Yeah, Gary, I greet you in the name of my African gods and my African ancestors, and I must say that you are truly two of the beer cubs that Marcus Garvey said would unleash.
Thank you.
You're living up to tradition. First, I just want to share with you, the sister had asked about Cain and Abel. There's a book she can get, Hebrew Myths, the Book of Genesis, by Robert Graves and Raphael Patai, and that will explain her question about Cain and Abel.
It's called what again?
Hebrew Myths, M-Y-T-H-S, the Book of Genesis by Robert Graves and Raphael Patai, P-A-T-A-I. Mm-hmm. And they'll explain a lot of the myths, the Hebrew myths in the Bible, self-explanatory. She can pick it up for less than $6.
Who's the publisher?
McGraw-Hill.
Okay,
McGraw-Hill paperbacks.
Great.
Okay. Now, I'm an African who believe in race vindication, and you have a set of people who are going around still masquerading as leaders, misleading our people and telling us to be nonviolent. Your comment, Professor Wilson.
Mm-hmm. Certainly at times, violence is justifiable. In fact, I was talking to my classes earlier. There are times in struggling against oppression when violence, unfortunately, is called for and has to be used. Of course, I'm one who advocates only using violence when necessary, but recognizes the necessity of violence at times. Mm-hmm. Which means, though, that violence, when it is perpetrated, must be perpetrated as the result of clear thinking and planning and organization, and not as reactionary, impulsive kinds of as a result of reactionary, impulsive kinds of behavior. And so one of the reasons why I kind of tend not to wholesalely talk about violence is because often you see many people who have not worked through who they are and what they are will engage in the kind of violence that brings more trouble than and creates more problems than it solves.
WLIB, you're on the air with Professor Amos Wilson, live before 5. Go right ahead, please.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Professor Wilson.
Yes, ma'am.
I have enjoyed your remarks
Thank you very much.
I want to ask you, first of all, do you agree that when a very successful man or woman gets married, they generally seek the person who meets their physical ideals, satisfies their ideal perfection?
Certainly, that is almost always a part of making the choice of a mate.
Well, will you please comment on the fact that more and more very successful black men, and not so successful, but nevertheless, are marrying white women? And that when they do, as my observation, and I have occasion, I live in a complex where there are 7 such couples, all between successful black men and white women. They absolutely adore them and treat them like queens and are sort of led around by the nose. They're very wimpish when married to white women.
Yes.
More so than most black men who are married to black women are.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I guess you could reverse that and say that when successful black women marry white men, they are also expressing certain attitudes. And I'd like to know what you think those attitudes are.
Okay, there are many. There are many related to this kind of behavior. Of course, a good deal of it is related to the fact that much of what we call education is the result of being made Eurocentric in our values and orientations. And therefore, we come to value things European as a result of being submitted, as a result of being brainwashed by the kind of education we often find necessary to succeed. And as a part of that, the European woman comes to represent to symbolize the ultimate in that kind of a system. She comes to represent what it means to marry a woman. She also comes to symbolize success. She comes to symbolize equality for black men, implying that his ability to marry her makes him equal to a white man because the white man marries this woman, and therefore he being able to do so now is equal. So it sort of caps off his success and symbolizes his success. Involved in that also is a form of self-hatred, through which the individual commits what I call biological suicide, in that they often want to create children who do not look like them. If they have been convinced consciously and unconsciously that they are ugly, that the African features are not desirable, then often they will be motivated to create children who do not have features that look like themselves. And in a sense, it's a type of psychological beautification of the man himself, who transforms himself through his children by the fact now that they look different. Many black males equate the marrying of being with white women as indicative of their manhood. And the fact that the black manhood, masculinity, is often attacked in so many different ways. The getting of a white woman to love him implies that he has achieved manhood as such. Mm-hmm. Also, the education itself often alienates the black person from black culture and from the mainstream of black people, such that he finds that he can only be satisfied by moving, by marrying or relating to these other people. Plus, I've heard some black men say it's a good way of getting promoted and moved up in position, because it sort of signals to the other side that you are right, you know.
There's something that you said just a moment ago that I think in terms of maybe at the sake of going back and regressing for a moment, mm-hmm. you mentioned that there is in the adoption of a Eurocentric value system, mm-hmm. which then becomes the way to get the reward and the benefit of being in the society, as you were mm-hmm. talking about a bit earlier, mm-hmm. that in that process of adapting and actually accepting that we actually lose our own Afrocentricity,
yes.
and in some instances find that perhaps either man or woman, mm-hmm. that suddenly you can only relate to people of a Eurocentric value system.
You see, a part of becoming an educated servant is, of course, you have to become alienated to a good degree from your group. So moving up, it sort of goes together there, you see.
Mm.
If you're going to enjoy our wealth, make sure you don't transfer it back to the other people, and make sure you don't transfer the knowledge back.
Ooh.
And the whole bit. There's always that hidden contract for success for black people. And you will often hear black people, well, I didn't get this position because, you know, of my blackness. I got it because of my qualifications. And it's often only a black person you hear making that statement, which is an expression of the contract. Don't worry about me transforming now what I've gotten into black power and bringing other black people into it, white folk, you know. Therefore, I'm a safe bet. on your part. And in a sense, it's almost an obligatory statement that we have to make in order to be accepted by that other group.
Mm.
But in the process of becoming accepted, we often then lose that emotional and other kind of attachment with our own.
WLIB, you're on the air with Professor Amos Wilson.
Yeah, Brother Bert.
Afternoon.
I've been trying to get it for so long. Professor Wilson.
Yes, sir.
I would like to know how enthralled is the Stockholm Syndrome to our race of our people that create our problem? I'm sure you're aware of what the Stockholm Syndrome is.
It has a certain familiarity, but could you explain it to me a little bit?
Well, the Stockholm Syndrome was some time ago where a certain number of people were held on a train, and when they came off the train, they were all in favor of the personal victimizer.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. I understand what you're saying now. When you're talking about often people who are made hostage, this is also a part of the a piece today that we didn't get to, that instilling of self-hatred into a person. Often when a person is held hostage, there's a kind of thought that takes place in the sense that let's look at it in terms of white and black. The fact that we are oppressed by these people.
We're their hostage.
Pardon me?
Are they hostage?
He's saying we're their hostage.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. And often many individuals will read that as meaning then that they must have something really going for them. They must be good. They must be great, or else I won't be in this position. So in that sense, even though one is held hostage, one seeks to identify with them. Also, don't forget that often when one is being held hostage, one is a captive audience. And there's a control of information and control of behavior like we talked about earlier. And these things, too, are used to condition the individual into a relationship, often with the person who's holding them hostage. Often, too, if they engage in debate or because they're in the position they're in, they come to doubt the values and orientations that they had before. And often because they are alienated from the people who helped them to maintain the original values, the values begin to fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
And the individual then begins to replace them by the new kinds of values. Also in a hostage situation, in the situation that we find ourselves as black people, there is an implied demand there. And you can see it in the father-child relationship. The father says, you are being punished because you are not like me. You see, you don't think like me, you don't act like me, you don't do what I tell you to do, you don't look like me, and the whole bit. And so the child makes a logical conclusion that says, well, then I can escape being punished and hurt if I could be what? More like daddy, think like mm-hmm. them, you know, be like them and assume their behavior. I would be released from the pain. So consequently, the individual who is suffering as a result, often the way we've suffered under these people, we assume that if we can identify with them, if they cannot see any difference between ourselves and themselves, then we would no longer be victimized by them. So consequently, the oppressed individual is motivated by his pain often to identify and become totally one with the people who are the source of that pain.
That is amazing. We'll take a break at 1190 WLIB Radio in the Key of Life. We have a couple of minutes of announcements, and then we'll take a break for news headlines on the half hour. Professor Wilson, if you got a bit more time, we'll wrap up the week and the afternoon with some of the callers who've been holding on. Stand by, those of you listening, and for those of you who are right now sort of like in your cars or at work and who have basically stopped to digest some of this, I'm sure that your brain is doing what mine is. We'll come back right after this at WLIB Radio in the Key of Life.
Good evening, and Esplanade Garden, we had a wonderful black co-op. Mm-hmm. And what did they do? They took it so that the unions would not deliver. So we have tried, and that's a big development.
Mm-hmm.
But they said no, no, no.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the way they handle it.
Yes.
Good.
We have to realize that as I've often mentioned to others, that when we really struggle for self-control and independence, I mean, you're really in a war, and you're going to have some casualties, and people are going to throw some body blows at you, and we have to be prepared to accept the consequences and try to deal with those consequences. But getting to know who we are and getting over the kinds of conflicts that have been created in us through this process of self-hatred will permit us to develop a creativity that will often help us to get around the roadblocks that these people are going to try to throw in our way as we move toward independence and power.
WLIB, good afternoon. You're on the air with Professor Amos Wilson.
Peace, Gary. Brother Wayne, how you doing?
Wayne, good afternoon,
peace, brother.
Brother
Wayne.
All right.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Brother, the brother is dealing, Gary.
Indeed.
He's dealing. Brother Amos, if you would be so kind as to share with us, I have a question about dealing with those brothers and sisters within the community who are very committed to their blackness and their African heritage. But when they're approached about getting into an economic mindset,
yes,
and developing an economic prosperity within the community,
mm-hmm,
which can support the community, they're turned off. They don't,
yes,
want to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Could you speak on that?
Very definitely, because this is something I'm very much concerned with, and it, as a way of putting it, a plug, I wish the public would come by and see us over there at Harlem Graphic Arts, because we are trying to deal with this kind of situation. And one of the things we're trying to demonstrate over there at Harlem Graphic Arts is that black nationalism has a definite economic outcome, and that it's just not a philosophy. Many people have been led to think, to see black nationalism as an attitude, you know, so you get a lot of people saying, well, you know, I don't sleep with white women, I don't do so, as if that is the end and be all of what black nationalism is about. Ultimately, black nationalism has to justify itself in a way that says, by believing and supporting the nationalist program, you increase wealth, you increase power. It is not a vote for poverty. It is not a vote for deprivation.
Right.
And we have to make that very, very clear. Many of our people have been traumatized by the economic system. We see ourselves as having been taken into slavery and taken advantage of because of quote-unquote capitalism and economic greed. And consequently, we have a phobia often about money and where money and wealth fits within the African community. And consequently, many people will not face up to it rationally and squarely, but will have what almost a knee-jerk reaction to the issue of money and wealth because of its association with their exploitation and misuse and abuse. We are going to have to confront the issue of where money fits and where wealth fits within black growth and development and advancement, and deal with the anxiety that brings about. Many of us are afraid that that wealth and so forth will lead us off the African path, as if Africa somehow did not create wealth and was based on wealth. The other thing I look at is you have what I call a pseudo-nationalism out there.
Mm.
It's a nationalism that is reactive.
Mm.
Are people who have really not gotten over their self-hatred,
mm,
but who try to deal with their self-hatred by an over-glorification of African things and an obsession, a compulsive, obsessive relationship to African history, assume and therefore try to make up for their feeling of inferiority by narcissistically getting involved deeply in history and singing it out, and therefore being so narcissistically obsessed by the history, they fail to see the other vital things that are necessary for advancing us as a people.
They don't use the history, in other words.
No, they don't use the history, and the history is limited. See, it's what I said earlier, where people will study Egyptian history, but they will not study Egyptian economics. And they will not look at the relationship between the economic system and the culture. And they are trying to compensate for their personality defect by glorifying their African heritage, which should be done, but that is not going to solve the problem. And often then they become obsessed by it. The other thing, often people who join black nationalist organizations, these pseudo-nationalists, still have not gained their self-confidence. Many of them have joined in order to be accepted by whites, and that's a strange kind of thing, you know. In the sense that you have some people writing African history who have written that history not because they love Africans so much or themselves so much, but they have praised Egypt and praised this and praised that in the hope that if whites one day would recognize the greatness of these things and ultimately recognize the greatness of black people, then whites would accept them and love them as equals, you see. So there's still the motivation of seeking approval behind often this nationalism. Often also behind nationalism, which appears on the surface to be a hatred or a hostility toward whites, actually covers over a love for these people. But it's the kind of thing that says, well, since you won't accept me, I got mad and I'm going to, you know, talk about you. I'm going to create this attitude such that, in a sense, I'm going to frighten you into loving me, and I'm going to show you that it's our right to love me. One other thing. We have to be cautious of people whose leadership is based upon the poverty of black people and upon the misery of black people. Often there is an unconscious drive and motive to maintain that misery as a foundation for their own status and a foundation for their own leadership. So often you see individuals speaking in the name of the advancement of black people and for the development of black people, but when you actually watch their behavior, almost any move you make toward advancing and developing black people is negated by them, often in the name of some African system or some African economic approach that said, well, Africans don't engage in business, or Africans don't get into capitalist development or this kind of business. So they are paralyzed by their ambivalence toward, if I move the people up, then where will I fit in a new system? Also, there's a lack of self-confidence that says, as long as we're in the condition we're in, I can be leaders and I don't have to deal with the outside world. So often you have these people, while spouting the African nationalist code, are still hiding and escaping from the direct confrontation that's going to be necessary to move us forward as people.
Amazing. Wayne, thank you for the call. WIB, you're on the air with Professor Amos Wilson. Go right ahead, please.
Good afternoon, Gary, and good afternoon to Professor Amos.
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
I'd like the professor to comment on certain famous people who alter their natural African features, people like Michael Jackson, Jackson, Latoya Jackson, and Rebe Jackson.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's essentially what we've indicated this afternoon of people who essentially people who are dealing with the concept of self-hatred by trying to transform their physical features to more resemble the people in power, and hoping then that through this transformation they will be accepted and not identified directly with a group that has negative connotations. To a pretty much good extent, this is what that involves. Mm-hmm. When you attack people's hair, when you attack their color and things like this, mm-hmm. they often then will seek to change their hair and change colors, you, as the Garvey piece indicated,
right,
to try to more closely resemble. If the enemy cannot recognize you as different, then he has no basis for making you a victim, because discrimination implies reacting to a person on the basis of difference.
You're indicating
so you reduce the difference in order to reduce the suffering.
You're indicating then that that's somewhat the apex of self-hatred, at that point that you physically, literally transform.
Very. Very much so. Mm-hmm.
WIB, good afternoon. You're on there with Professor Amos Wilson.
Yes, Professor and Gary.
Yes.
Professor, the problems that I face as a black person, and I think all black people face, seems to me stem from the fact that our forefathers were slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And as I see it, not wanting to sound pessimistic, mm-hmm. but the evils of slavery have followed us for 500 years,
yes.
and it seems as if it's going to continue to follow us.
Yes.
So I like to back up a little and say, let's go back now to 1441.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are in Africa. We have gold, we have elephant tusks, which yes. are valuable up to today.
Mm-hmm.
We know then that the University of Timbuktu was on par with Oxford and Cambridge University.
Right.
So, I mean, it's not part of your education.
Yes.
Along come the Portuguese guys to make a trade.
Mm-hmm.
He gets gold. He gets elephant tusk. He gets 10 human beings as slaves.
Mm-hmm.
What happened in that trade? There was a breakdown there, because I don't think the African got anything to compare what he gave up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You, the question you asked is a very, very vital one, and I wish it would certainly take more time we have today to deal with that issue. I think in dealing with our so-called problems and self-hatred, we are really going to have to confront the issue of our own participation in part of in our enslavement as such, and what part did we pay, and I think Chancellor Williams begins to deal with that to a good extent.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of psyche did we have as a people that permitted often us to trade each other in slavery? Of course, we'd have to speculate that a slave system already existed to a degree. The Arab slave trading that existed there that also had created a slave system of exchange. Also, the idea that I mentioned very early in the program of where desires have been provoked through for items, for materials, and things that the Europeans had and created. And, of course, once those desires were provoked, the demands for slaves were made in exchange for those items, or where divisions existed between certain African groups, perhaps as a result of, as Williams talked about, as they moved further down into the continent and they break up into various groups and linguistic groups and so-called tribal groups, and these tribal differences are being exploited by Europeans to buy slaves, and where one group is pitted against another group in terms of, let us say, weapons trade. I'll give you weapons to move you so that you can have economic and political power, but that would, if you only get this weapon at the behest of selling me some other person's group.
Mm-hmm.
Plus fitting maybe into a tradition where people captured in war were permitted to perhaps be traded. You have all of these kinds of things that existed, I think, and of course Dr. Benz and other people could be much more clear about this than I am, that perhaps laid a groundwork for a lot of the activity that we engaged in. A very interesting book in that regard, too, if you can find it, is the book by Chinwezu called The West and the Rest of Us. And he deals very directly with that issue of African slave traders, Africans themselves. And to a good extent, he tries to show the relationship between that group and current neocolonial leadership, and I can see even a relationship between that group and current leadership even within the African-American community that often seeks to sell its people out for trinkets like stereos,
mm-hmm,
and a car, mm-hmm, house on the corner and things like that that involves selling other people out. Of course, you do that when you produce a certain amount of alienation among people such that they can do this kind of selling because they have been given a rationale through brainwashing and miseducation that this can be done without guilt.
Let's get to a couple more telephone,
yes,
calls, and we will have completed actually those who are at least on hold for most of the afternoon. WLIB, go right ahead, please. You're on the air with Professor Amos Wilson. Hello.
Oh, hello, Gary.
Yes, good afternoon.
I was holding so long, I kind of forgot I was...
I know, we've been trying to get to you. Good afternoon. What's the question?
Yeah, relevant to the issue we're talking about today about self-hatred. My name is Zakiya Newman from New Mind Productions.
Yes.
And Professor Wilson is probably familiar with Dr. Akbar's work on chains,
very,
and images of psychological slavery.
Very much.
But also, mm-hmm, I wanted to mention another book entitled An African American Genesis,
mm-hmm,
which I thought was very relative to something that was mentioned earlier about us recreating ourselves as,
mm-hmm,
a new people. And this book is by Imam Warsdeen Muhammad, who of course has a lot of insight into, you know, what the Nation of Islam was about.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, our needs as a people. So I wanted to mention that. This book is not available right now, but it will be very soon.
I appreciate that mention.
An African American Genesis.
Great. You know, this is actually African American Genesis is perhaps the struggle that we're talking about. There is a kind of from the beginning going through to now that when we look at maybe the crime of not getting our history in terms of the educational system, that in itself is one crime. But the perspective that we should actually be gaining from the study of that history is almost equally as important as getting that history itself.
I said earlier, Gary, and let me just make... You see, the rediscovery of African culture, let me just put it this way quickly, because since we don't have much time, I had a note here. Because he must have been robbed of his common sense. And we recognize that, I mentioned earlier, we have to be dumb to exist in this situation, you see.
Crazy, for sure.
Yeah, because he must have been robbed of his common sense, his intellectual capacities, his culture, creativity, and sense of reality has to have been taught to be dumb. The black man will experience a consciousness and intellectual expansion and a clarity of vision and spiritual harmony and increase in intelligence when he summons the courage to regain and reclaim his alienated self and culture. We must recognize, you see, when you talk about people robbing you of history, they're not only robbing you of history, of self-knowledge, they are robbing you of intelligence. They are robbing you of a clarity of vision. They are also robbing you of intellectual character and wisdom, because the control of information upon which we build intellect and wisdom and vision and so forth is restricted, you see. We are in a very peculiar situation of where people who create us because they have control of things, and yet they become our sole authorities for what reality is, you see. And therefore we are thrown back up on them as the authority for telling us who and what we are. And consequently, we can never get out of the box we're in. This is why in the long run, it is the greatest liars in the world who also are the greatest validators of truth. And so you have a situation here of where all, we have been boxed in mentally, psychologically, and in every other way.
What can I say, brother?
It's been a pleasure indeed.
What an afternoon. This is only one, though, of many I hope that we will have.
I hope we'll be able to pursue, though, the behavior that comes out of this. And I want to get to the fact that most of us as black do not experience ourselves as hating ourselves. We experience self-hatred as a self-love, and I want to deal with that, and I want to talk about how our self-hatred comes out in the form of love and deal with the whole concept of criminality, drug behavior, sex behavior, having babies, and finally to move into a real solid program for getting us out of this situation.
Okay, we'll call this phase one then.
Yes,
point one on the pyramid. All right, good enough. Thank you, brother.